provided by Thomas Allgaier and Frenis, based on the most relevant posts on LinkedIn about venture capital in CW3132, Frenis is a B2B market research company working with enterprises to optimize their campaigns with account and executive insights far beyond AI.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're pulling back the curtain on the top venture capital trends that have really been buzzing across LinkedIn over the past couple of weeks.
That's right. Our mission today, really, is to give you a sharp, distilled look at what's truly driving the market. You know, where the capital is flowing, how investor relationships are changing pretty rapidly, actually.
Yeah, and we'll be exploring these shifts through the lens of recent insights shared by, well, some pretty influential voices in the VC space.
Absolutely. Think of this as your essential shortcut, understanding the pulse of venture capital right now, cutting through the noise to get to those core insights you really need.
So you can stay well informed.
Okay, let's unpack this then. It's really clear AI continues to be a central theme in venture capital, right? But the investment landscape around it,
yeah,
it's definitely shifting. It's not just about throwing money at any AI idea anymore, is it? What are we seeing there? Like, where's the capital landing and what kind of AI is getting the attention?
You're spot on. The focus on AI is, well, undeniable. And we're seeing some very specific areas pop up. Patricia Beck, for instance, highlighted a really significant trend. AI models are now specifically aiming to replace clinicians.
Wow. Replace clinicians?
Yeah, particularly in mental health. It's a powerful, almost stark observation from Beck. She noted the VC endgame here isn't exactly subtle. It's about, quote, owning mental health by replacing human care with cheaper AI solutions. So it's not just about efficiency. It's potentially a fundamental shift in how healthcare gets delivered.
That's a pretty provocative insight. So if that's the endgame, what are investors looking for in these AI ventures? Are they just, you know, chasing the flashiest tech?
Not really, no. What's truly fascinating here, and something Gilla Berenstain really underscored, is that investors are now heavily emphasizing competitive moats.
Moats.
Okay. Yeah, we're talking proprietary data, brand trust, agility,
right?
That sort of thing.
Yeah.
It suggests a clear move beyond just the AI tech itself.
Right.
It's more about how it's defensibly built, how it can maintain an advantage in what's becoming a very crowded market. Yeah. It's about longevity, not just novelty.
So sustainability, a clear path to market dominance. And speaking of how these companies are built, Alex Lieberman raised an interesting point about venture capital effectively subsidizing the cost of compute, which heavily incentivizes companies to buy rather than build AI solutions right now. How does that reshape strategic roadmaps across different sectors?
Well, it creates a fascinating dynamic, doesn't it? If VC money makes compute so affordable, then yeah, strategic roadmaps are being shaped by these subsidies that pushes companies towards external, sort of off-the-shelf AI solutions for the immediate future.
Makes sense. Why build from scratch if you don't have to?
Exactly. Why pour resources into building when it's cheaper and faster to integrate existing powerful models? And this also plays into the increasing involvement of corporate venture arms.
Ah, the CVCs.
Right. Davide Bertordo noted that while overall CVC activity actually hit a 7-year low.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but there's been a significant strategic shift within that towards AI and deep tech.
Yeah.
They're not just opportunistic investors anymore. They seem to be deploying capital with a real strategic lens.
That's a significant pivot for corporate VCs. And if we look at the broader VC landscape, John Sicotta made a pretty eye-opening statement. VCs have essentially gone all in on AI.
All in.
Yeah, something like a staggering 60% of all VC dollars flowing into the sector. Sicotta even predicts a supercycle of capital intensity in 2025.
Wow.
What does that kind of concentrated investment mean for the market? Good and bad, I guess.
It's definitely a double-edged sword, isn't it? I mean, on one hand, such a massive influx of capital, it accelerates innovation at an incredible pace, pushes boundaries in AI development.
Sure.
But on the other hand, it creates intense competition for talent, drives up valuations like crazy, and puts immense pressure on companies to grow at an almost unsustainable rate.
Right, that super cycle intensity.
Exactly. It implies rapid burn rates and a fierce battle for market dominance. So the critical question here becomes, what's the long-term play? You know, when so much capital is flowing into just one area.
Are we building sustainable businesses?
Or is there a risk of an overheated market, where maybe many fail to find a viable path to profitability once those subsidies inevitably dry up or the market matures? It really requires founders and investors alike to think beyond the immediate hype.
That's a crucial consideration. And as we see these shifts in capital deployment, it inevitably impacts the dynamics within fundraising and investor relationships.
Mm-hmm.
We're definitely seeing a real recalibration in expectations from investors, aren't we? The game feels like it's changed for founders.
It absolutely has. Shaurya Mehrotra put this really well. VCs aren't necessarily saying no outright anymore.
Okay.
They're just asking better questions. This isn't about rejecting innovation. It's about demanding more rigor. Mm. Founders absolutely need to know their numbers inside out.
Like burn rate.
Burn rate, time to break even, and especially user retention without relying on discounts. The emphasis has really shifted from, you know, shouting the loudest.
Right.
To scaling the smartest, demonstrating capital efficiency and a clear path to profitability.
So it's less storytelling, more hard data. How does this recalibration affect how founders should approach raising capital then,
yeah,
beyond just crunching their numbers?
It fundamentally changes the dynamic. Shriram Sundararajan stressed that founders should be evaluating investors just as much as they are being evaluated.
Interesting. Two-way street.
Exactly. It's no longer just a founder pitching. It's about finding true alignment, not just chasing a maybe from any investor who might listen. Sundararajan also highlighted the vital importance of knowing where a fund is in its life cycle.
Why does that matter so much now?
Because timing and thesis fit now matter far more than just general market hype. And this connects directly to Kevin Jiang's stark reminder. Raising, say, $10 million or any significant sum. It means selling control, not just securing funding.
Oof, selling control.
Yeah, you're not just getting money, you're committing to hitting someone else's targets on their timeline. It's about whose vision you're ultimately building.
That really puts a different, maybe more sober spin on fundraising for founders. It definitely shifts the power dynamic. And speaking of investors, what about those corporate VCs themselves? You mentioned the shift to AI. Are they facing unique challenges and opportunity?
They certainly are. Susan Lindner, in a really compelling conversation with Andy Goldstein of Venture University, highlighted a killer stat that really stands out.
Okay.
Corporate VCs miss out on a massive 70% of top deals.
70%? Why?
Because startups often avoid them. There's this perceived misalignment of incentives or strategic goals. Startups worry about getting swallowed up or just slowed down by corporate bureaucracy.
Okay, that makes sense. 70% is huge, though.
Yep.
So how do corporate VCs bridge that gap? How do they access those top deals?
Well, Andy Goldstein suggested an intriguing solution, something called venture clienting.
Venture clienting.
Yeah. In this model, corporates act as clients instead of investors. They engage startups for their products or services, potentially seeing 100% of deals because they're approaching it from a customer perspective, right? Not an ownership one.
So it removes that perceived conflict for startups.
Exactly. And Andrew Matuzak added to this, saying that for CVCs, the deal shouldn't be the finish line, but rather the starting point for shaping outcomes and relationships.
Mm. Building an ecosystem.
Yeah, fostering collaboration, not just writing a check. It's a move toward the more symbiotic relationship.
It really sounds like the traditional VC model is being challenged on multiple fronts, especially concerning how capital is structured at those crucial early stages. We also saw some pretty strong opinions circulating about preferred shares, didn't we?
Indeed, yeah. Itamar Novick and Adeo Ressi both passionately advocated for eliminating preferred shares, specifically at the seed stage.
Eliminating them entirely.
Yeah. Their argument is that these shares, which typically grant investors specific rights like liquidation preferences before common shareholders get anything, they just introduce unnecessary complexity.
Right.
They believe it shifts the focus away from genuinely building value towards just managing downside protection for investors.
Right.
Ressi even quoted top Silicon Valley lawyers who independently said, eliminate preferred to improve funding.
Interesting.
The belief is that common stock would lead to faster, simpler funding rounds, significantly less legal costs, and much clearer cap tables, ultimately fostering true partnership.
That's a pretty radical thought, though, given how entrenched preferred shares are in the current system. What are the deeper implications if that were to change?
Well, it raises a fundamental question about the very structure of early stage capital, right?
Mm-hmm.
Elijah Scheidt emphasized that VCs need founders just as much as founders need VCs. It's a mutual dependency.
It's true partnership.
Exactly. So if preferred shares are seen as a barrier to that true partnership, then maybe moving to common stock could fundamentally reshape that dynamic. It could signal a shift towards a more equitable, more transparent relationship between investors and founders, where everyone's incentives are more closely aligned towards shared success rather than just, you know, downside protection.
streamlining things to focus on building great companies.
Precisely.
That's certainly something to think about.
Yeah.
Especially as we shift gears now to some of the, let's say, harder realities of the market and venture performance. We've heard some sobering stories about companies imploding despite having seemingly great products.
Absolutely. Yeah, Tim Deason shared the really stark example of CityMapper.
CityMapper. Everyone uses that.
Exactly. Here's an app with widespread adoption, clear product market fit. Yet early investors experienced significant losses.
Wow.
It directly challenges that long-held assumption that product market fit automatically translates to investor returns. This is a tough lesson. User love doesn't always equal financial success.
Right.
And this ties into Anne-Lai's criticism of the one big win investment philosophy. She argues it kind of warped into VCs just spraying capital broadly.
Spray and pray.
Kind of. And the consequence, founders getting stuck on funding life support, constantly chasing the next round rather than building sustainable businesses. Thomas Wirth added to this, suggesting that maybe too much risk aversion in VC could lead to fewer failures, yes, but also lower upside, implying bold, calculated risk-taking is still key for outperformance.
So it's not enough to build a great product. It has to be a great business. And this focus on sustainability brings us to some serious warnings about market risks and debt structures that are emerging.
Exactly. Peter J. Merrick, along with Adrian C. Spitters, raised significant concerns about the collapse of overleveraged consumer brands, like Hooters and Red Lobster.
Those are big names.
Huge. Their analysis highlighted how private equity, for years, pumped these companies with massive amounts of debt. Now, with interest rates rising, there's a real risk of contagion across the broader market. Merrick even signaled potential impacts on retirement savings vehicles, which is, you know, a critical point for everyone to consider.
That's a powerful warning. It's not just about startups anymore. It's hitting foundational elements of the economy. What's driving this vulnerability, and what are the lessons here for founders and investors today?
Well, the core issue, as Peter J. Merrick really underscored, is that inflated valuations and those growth at any cost narratives, they're crumbling as the cost of capital normalizes.
The easy money era is over.
Pretty much. James Hickson provided clear death spiral of overvaluation examples. Think WeWork, Fisker. He emphasized that unrealistic valuations, not just product failure, can lead to catastrophic collapses.
So what's the advice?
Hickson offers practical advice for founders. Base valuations on realistic revenue projections, specifically like 3 to 5 times realistic 24-month revenue, not these exorbitant 300% premiums to public comparables.
So grounding expectations in reality, not just chasing inflated numbers. This raises a really crucial question for anyone in the venture ecosystem. How can we collectively foster a culture of realistic valuation and sustainable growth? Instead of just perpetuating hype and the pursuit of unrealistic benchmarks, it feels like a shift in mindset as much as strategy.
Precisely. Yeah, it requires discipline from both sides of the table. But, you know, amidst these cautionary tales, it's not all doom and gloom.
Good.
There are also some promising regional developments that seem to be bucking some of these broader trends, which offers a bit of hope.
Okay, that's good to hear. Where are we seeing these pockets of resilience and growth?
Well, take the UK. While overall it saw its slowest quarter of VC investment in 5 years, Fred Sonia's report highlighted a remarkable resilience in its early stage VC ecosystem.
Early stage.
Yeah. We're talking $9 billion investment in 2024 with an impressive 80% surge in seed deals.
Wow, 80% surge in seed.
Right. It suggests that while later stage funding might be tightening, the very foundation of innovation is still pretty robust there. And Lewis Stringer also pointed out that the Midlands specifically buck the national trend, quadrupling its VC investment in Q2 2025.
Quadrupling? In the Midlands?
Yeah. It indicates that these localized growth pockets are not only surviving, but actually thriving, maybe driven by unique regional strengths or perhaps a more grounded approach to investment.
That's an encouraging sign. It proves not every region just follows the broader market tide. Okay, finally, let's maybe wrap up by considering how diversity and innovation are reshaping the VC landscape. What does it truly mean for the future of venture capital?
This is such a powerful and, frankly, necessary shift. Itzel Moncada is really leading the charge in redefining what it even means to be an emerging manager in VC.
How so?
She's focusing on practical, actionable criteria, like AUM, whether they're newer firms, or crucially, if there's at least one woman GP on the founding team. It moves beyond just abstract concepts to tangible metrics for identifying and supporting diverse leadership.
Making it measurable.
Exactly. And Alita Gagamova even shared a curated list of 20 active VC firms that are specifically supporting female founders across various sectors.
Yeah.
This isn't just about optics. It's about actively broadening the pipeline, ensuring more diverse voices and ideas actually get funded.
That's a powerful move towards inclusivity. And I imagine smart investment, too. It really ties directly into a broader, more impactful vision for venture capital, doesn't it?
It absolutely does.
Yeah.
Debbie Waskow provided a fantastic example with Serena Williams' firm, Serena Ventures.
Oh, yeah.
They've backed an incredible 85 companies, including 14 unicorns, which demonstrates exceptional returns, right?
14 unicorns, wow.
But perhaps more importantly, their partnership with Reckitt through the 10 million pound Reckitt Catalyst Initiative. That truly shows how VC can actively address overlooked problems in areas like hygiene, maternal care, health equity.
Things that often get missed.
Exactly. And this isn't just philanthropy. It's smart, scalable business that expands the table for who gets funded and what problems get solved. It powerfully demonstrates how values-aligned investment can drive both significant financial returns and profound social impact.
It's realizing diversity isn't just a moral imperative.
It's an economic accelerator.
If you enjoyed this deep dive, new episodes drop every 2 weeks. Also, check out our other editions on private equity, M&A, and strategy and consulting. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the latest in venture capital.
Yeah, we hope these insights offer you a clearer picture of the dynamic, ever-changing world of VC.
As you reflect on these shifts, capital efficiency, partnership dynamics, market realities, maybe consider this. What does it truly mean to build to last in an environment where capital is both abundant and, well, increasingly discerning? Until next time, keep exploring and stay well informed.